They eventually take her to a hospital and they restrain her and they keep her in the hospital for 4 days where she's basically not allowed to do anything. She can't go to the bathroom by herself. They take samples from her all the time. And all of these samples come back covered full of typhoid, Salmonella typhi. Hi, I'm Trevor Craig and I'm a scientist.
Hi, I'm Brittany Hansen and I'm a pop culture enthusiast. And this is OK, But Why?, a Microback Laboratories podcast about science and pop culture.
Hi, I'm Trevor Craig. I am the Corporate Technical Director of Training Consulting with Microback. I have been with the company for about 6 years now, and I have been in the food testing industry for over 15 years now.
And I'm Brittany Hansen. I'm the marketing manager here at Microback for about 8 months, covering all things social, email marketing, and PR.
And I think the first thing we wanted to touch base on is exactly where this podcast was birthed and why we decided this was something that Microback wanted to do and that why we wanted to do it. When I first joined the company, we were going through a big change in the company. Alexandra, who is both of our, we both report to her. She is a third generation founder from the family there, and she wanted to come in, and one of the things she was really focused on was making Microback more than just a testing company. And that's kind of where our mission statement came from, making the world better one test at a time. And the way we were focused on doing that is not just doing testing, but also being a source of enlightenment and education for not just our clients, but anyone who was tuning in and listening. So that's kind of where we started coming up with ideas of how we could do that. And we had lots of different ideas and we are doing lots of different things on how we did that. But one of those ideas that came up was starting a podcast and how we can take that mission statement into a podcast that is, you know, entertaining and fun, but also something that's going to follow that mission statement and be enlightening and be educational for everybody out there, not just people who are doing testing. And I think that's kind of where the podcast idea was birthed. And then we kind of grew from there when we start working with each other in a marketing and a PR team, because we are coming up with ideas on how to do this. And we were getting in long conversations where essentially, I'll go ahead and admit, I would go on tangents about something that I was finding really interesting, but that was also catching the ears of our marketing and PR team. And they were saying, like, why are we doing that? And where does that come from? And how does this happen? Or why are people doing this? Or, you know, why do we test for those kind of things? And I was going into these great big tangents of all of these pop culture stories that I knew that no one else really knew, or they kind of had heard of them before, but didn't realize that that's why we do some of the stuff that we do. And that's kind of where the podcast idea was birthed from, was to kind of align a really cool conversation that we were having on a weekly basis along with our mission statement. And they just kind of aligned really easily from the beginning.
Yeah, I remember the first few calls I was on with our PR, the team was always asking, okay, but why did that happen, Trevor? And I really just think that this is our best chance to be able to share the stories authentically and be best executed through a podcast.
Yeah. And I do think it came really authentically because, you know, the title of the podcast, Okay, But Why?, was literally what we were hearing when we were having these conversations. Or, okay, but why is this a big deal? Or, you know, okay, but why do people care about this? Or why do we even do this testing? So it kind of was a rhetoric that we were hearing over and over in these conversations. And we kind of came up with the idea of let's actually make this into something a little bit more solid because other people are interested in this and not just me sitting at home babbling to people. It's maybe there's other people who'd like to hear me babble.
Yeah, I agree. Should we jump into it?
Yeah, let's get into our first story. So today's episode is about Mary Mallon, or what she's commonly known as is Typhoid Mary. Have you ever heard of Typhoid Mary or seen anything about her before?
I have heard of Typhoid Mary, but I would love for you to explain deeper what typhoid is.
Oh, sure. So typhoid is a infection that is caused by Salmonella typhi. Salmonella typhi is a serovar of Salmonella. So you probably have heard people talk about genus and species when they talk about bacteria. Mm-hmm. Serovar is another level of that. So there are, I probably should have looked this up before we started. I think around 3,000 serovars of Salmonella. And Salmonella typhi is one that is extremely, extremely dangerous. And when we talk about Typhoid Mary. This is in like the 1900s. So it's a little bit less dangerous now. Not less dangerous, less prevalent now. But it's still out there quite a bit. And a lot of what you see with happen with Typhoid Mary actually reflects on what we talk about when we talk about COVID, actually, and current salmonella outbreaks. So it's pretty interesting. It's one of my favorite stories.
Perfect. Tell me more about Mary then.
Okay. So Mary Mallon was born in Ireland in 1869, and she immigrated to the United States in 83 or 84 as a teenager. She started working as a maid while she worked with family and eventually worked up to a cook. And she worked as a cook because cooks made more than maids. And so that was kind of a specialization, and she could get a lot better money. And she started working for really affluent families. And that's pretty much the only people who could afford cooks. And there'd be like agencies that would kind of move her from house to house and those types of things. But where she really becomes important is between 1900 and 1907, she worked for families all across the U.S. And out of eight families she worked for, seven of the families that she worked for contracted typhoid fever. So she worked kind of jumping around a lot. Or in 1900, she worked for a family for about 2 weeks before they started developing typhoid fever. And most of the family got it then. She left, and then she went to another location in Manhattan. They also developed fever and diarrhea. She left that location, and then she started working for a lawyer. And then seven of the eight of the people that she worked for also became ill. So then in 1904, she moved again, and she was hired by another lawyer. But this time, about half of the servants got sick, but none of the family got sick. They think what was that caused that difference there was the family lived in a different house than the one that she lived in with the servants. So she was potentially cooking for the servants and not always the family. And that might have been the difference between why they got sick. She again left. As soon as people get sick, she kind of ends up leaving these jobs within a week. She gets another job, kind of moves away. She was notorious for moving without saying anything to anybody. And when we talk a little bit later, it's one of the reasons they had a hard time kind of tracking her down.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So first of all, this is prompting my first question. How is typhoid fever spread?
So that's really a difficult question to answer. And it's really important when we talk about Typhoid Mary in general, because it is spread through, it's called fecal-oral transmission, and it's just as gross as you think it is. And it is normally through contaminated water or through contaminated food. So there's some early signs here as she being the chef where it was coming from. But as you get kind of deeper in the story, you kind of find out exactly why this is a unique situation and why it got kind of, it got weird really fast. And it also, it touches on some ethical things as we go on too.
Perfect. Tell me more.
So she leaves this last foyer family where the servants get ill. And she immediately moves, and she was hired by a brand new family. In this new family, people get sick again. And one of the people who gets sick is a laundry worker, and the laundry worker is hospitalized. And because these are kind of affluent families, they're able to hire people that kind of track disease. And so they hire someone, and they come in, and they find out that this laundry worker has typhoid fever. And at this hospital, it was the first time they had seen it in a long time. And that was because it was kind of in an affluent area, so they didn't expect to see it. And the laundry worker eventually passes away. And the investigator says that it was the laundry worker got sick. She gave it to all these people. That's why they all got sick. But he could never really prove it. And Mary moves on again. And finally, in 1906, she is hired as a cook by Charles Warren. This is a wealthy New York banker. And they go on vacation to Oyster Bay, which is in Long Island for the summer. And they take Mary with her. And then from August 27th to September 3rd, six of the 11 people that are with them in this vacation house suddenly come down with typhoid fever. At this point in time, typhoid fever is still fatal in about 10% of the people who get it, which you think 10% isn't that high. But if you have a 10% chance of dying if you get a cold, that's kind of scary. And it comes up a lot more as you go further on.
So once you are infected, how long did it typically last?
So only 10% of the people died, and it could happen pretty quickly. And some people bounce back from it pretty quickly. It could only be a week or so. And some people were sick for really long periods of time. And even those who bounced back sometimes never fully recovered, and they would permanently have problems with their stomach going forward. Part of that might just be because we didn't have great medical care in 1907. We weren't doing the best with everything there. But part of it is when you get infections like salmonella, they can permanently wipe out your stomach healthy flora. I mean, that's what they talk about with all these probiotics. And once your healthy flora is messed up, it takes a long time to recover. And some people never do. So some people were permanently just changed after they got this. Some people died within days. Some people died within weeks. Unfortunately, most of the time you die from like dehydration just because you were losing so many fluids and you become like septic in some cases too.
My goodness. So you're saying that they probably didn't know the preventative measures to avoid getting it at that time?
So they knew sort of what typhoid fever was. They knew sort of how it got around. They had no treatments for it. This is before we had any sort of vaccine or we had any sort of antibiotic treatment for it. So if you got sick, they just basically gave you a bunch of fluids and took care of you as much as they could and hoped you fought it off and got better yourself, which wasn't always the case.
Oh my goodness. Okay, tell me more.
So they take all these people to the hospital. It's in Oyster Bay. Oyster Bay is a really rich area. That's where people are vacation. And it is extremely rare for them to see this. And the medical doctors who practice there are all like very confused about how this happened. It doesn't happen here because typhoid fever is almost always associated with kind of dirty water. So you see it in really big cities, but you see it only in the poorest of the areas. And that's because it spreads really quickly from person to person. They don't always have the best places to live and the cleanest habits. So it kind of moves around really quickly. You don't see it in rich people's houses. Because of this, they hired a bunch of investigators and the investigators came to the house. They interviewed people, they took all these samples and they sampled things like their pipes, their faucets, their toilets, the cesspool, which is disgusting to think that that was still a thing. And all of these samples came back negative. So they're kind of at a loss for where this typhoid was coming from. At the same time, a sanitary engineer, which is what they called him, which I don't know if that exists anymore. Sometimes I wonder if that would be my title now as a sanitary engineer. I'm glad it's not. And he comes and starts working from the Roran family. And his name is George Soper. And he is in this for the rest of the story. He's semi a villain. So it's kind of hard to decide who's to blame here. And we'll talk about the ethics as we go on. And he comes in and he starts looking at what's going on in this family. And he starts interviewing people, and he is convinced that the reason they all get sick is because of oysters and that they ate undercooked shellfish. But he starts talking to more people, and not all of the people who got sick ate the shellfish, and he starts looking around. And then he kind of comes across Mary, and he realizes that she matches the descriptions of other investigations he's done. So all these other outbreaks that in affluent families, he's having a similar description, and the description he is getting is of an Irish cook who, I'll read you his quote of what she looks like. It's kind of mean. And he realizes that Mary matches that. And so he starts to suspect that maybe it's coming from Mary. But Mary's never been sick. She's never had typhoid. She's never had any symptoms. And she's kind of moved from place to place. And she's never really talked about when she moves from place to place. So they can't really trace her and figure out what it is. But he thinks it's her. So he comes to her. And he essentially says, I think you're making these people sick. I need to collect some samples from you. And she goes off. She is mad about it because she's never sick. She's like, it's not me. I've never been sick. How can I give it to people? And she's like offended by the whole thing. And he keeps pressuring her. And eventually, according to several sources, she chases him away using like a fork. Like whatever she's using in the kitchen, she runs him out of her kitchen and says like, get out of here. Leave me alone kind of a thing. And he runs off. So she was kind of a feisty broad. And part of me like loves Mary because like she stood up for herself for quite a bit of time.
You touched on something really quickly there that I was just thinking about, how she never got sick, but she was giving it to everyone else. So I'm very curious how she could be spreading it, but not getting sick or dying herself.
So I'll talk about that more, but she's one of the first cases of this situation happening. And it plays out later on that this is how we learn this is even possible. So he runs out, or she runs him out, I guess, with a fork. But he decides he's going to go back and do some research. And he looks up her work history for the last 5 years. And that's where he discovers out of 8 families she works with, 7 of them got typhoid. And so it's this huge deal. And he's like trying to figure it out. But he's also can't really say anything to her and he can't go for her. And so there's kind of this back and forth with her. And she's pretty tricky because she did move pretty quickly. And one of the ethical things that comes up is, did she know that she was sick or that she could potentially be causing it and was leaving before anyone traced her? Or was she like, I'm not sick, I'm not the problem, but I need to make money, because she was always on borderline poverty level because she didn't have a house of her own. She was only making like $40 an hour or whatever the cost pay was for cooks. And so she was just trying to find the next job to keep working and to keep moving. So she keeps going like that one. he eventually describes her to the situation to the health department in New York, and they come back with another doctor, and they basically say, you have to go get this woman and pick her up and figure out what's going on here. So he goes to pick her up along with the doctor. I believe her name was Josephine. And they go and pick her up along with five cops, and she fights them the whole way. According to the story, they had to sit on her and restrain her in order for her to get into the ambulance and take her to the hospital. Like, Mary, she was not having any of it.
You go, Mary.
Yeah, so like, I'm on Mary's side for this. Like, she's scrappy. I really appreciate that about her. And this is his description of her that he sent out to a medical journal. It was found that the family changed cooks on August 4th. This was about 3 weeks before the typhoid epidemic broke out. The new cook, Malin, remained in the family only a short time and left about 3 weeks after the outbreak occurred. Malin had described as an Irish woman, about 40 years of age, tall, heavy, single. She seemed to be of perfect health. So that last clip is where we're talking about she seemed to be of perfect health. And this is one of the first cases that we see of a person who is a carrier that has no symptoms. Around that time, about 3,000 people, New Yorkers, had Salmonella typhi, and they're not really sure if they were all from Mary. They only attributed about 120 cases to her, but because it spreads so quickly, it is very possible that she could give it to someone who then gives it to someone who then gives it to someone, and it spreads very quickly. And it became a huge issue. So they eventually take her to a hospital, and they restrain her, and they keep her in the hospital for 4 days, where she's basically not allowed to do anything. She can't go to the bathroom by herself. They take samples from her all the time, and all of these samples come back covered full of typhoid, Salmonella typhi. So she has so much of it in her body. They think that she was storing it somehow in her gallbladder, and that she had it in her gallbladder, and that she was just shedding it constantly throughout her blood. Fecal matter and whatever else. During this time, they interview her, and she also openly admits that she doesn't wash her hands very often. Ooh. So she's a cook in your kitchen, not washing her hands, kind of spreading around Salmonella. This isn't necessarily her fault, though, because at that time, the whole theory of bacteria and hand washing was brand new and people didn't believe it. So, you know, I think that was probably more common than they thought, but I mean, hopefully we don't see that now.
Do we know if any of the guys at the jail ended up getting it?
So that's the thing, is they kept her at the hospital and they restrained her and no one got sick at the hospital. Afterwards, they actually quarantined her and they moved her to an island. So she ended up living on this island, the Willard Parker Hospital, which was on this island outside of New York. And she lived there for almost 3 years, isolated. And during this time, they essentially forced to take samples from her. And they took over 160 samples, and over 120 of them came back positive. So she was literally shedding Salmonella all over. But she didn't commit a crime. So they isolated her, arrested her, but they never committed her of a crime. So she was living on this island essentially by herself. All these doctors were coming towards her and kind of harassing her, basically, and saying, you have to do this, you have to do this, this is the problem, and you're making people sick. But she was never sick. And essentially, they kind of believe that they never really explained it to her, that they said that she was sick and that she was really difficult to work with. But it's also the 1900s, and like, she's a cook. So I imagine this PhD doctor guy comes in and is thinking he's probably being polite and explaining everything to her. And she's just heavily offended. And she's fighting for her life because she's trying to make money and stay off the streets. And she's she's cooking. She's not doing anything crazy. Like, how could she be making people sick? She's not sick. She's just cooking. Yeah. And she's just trying to make money. Like, why is this guy coming after her? So she's really, really resistant, according to the doctors. And they say they tried to treat her as best as possible, but she was, you know, scrappy. She was fighting them. She wouldn't help them and she wouldn't do anything with them. But she was testing positive. Eventually, she's there for almost 3 years, and there is a changeover in government, and the new person who comes in basically says, we're not going to people in jail, essentially, who are contaminated. Like, that's not fair. Like, what are they doing? And she, at the same time, had been working with a friend and sending secret samples to another laboratory, and their samples were coming up negative. So there was this kind of data back and forth that's, you know, one group was saying, she's sick, she's making all these people sick. She has data that says none of my samples are coming up positive when I send them to this other location and I'm not sick. And then there's this new person in government who is saying, like, this is wrong to treat people like this.
Sure.
She tries to sue the government, the health center, and basically say, you can't do this. She loses that lawsuit. But the guy basically says, We're going to release you. But the deal is, if you are released, and she was on this island, it was North Brother Island. If you were released, you can go back and live on the mainland, but you can't be a cook. And she agrees. She goes back to the island and she starts her job working as a laundry, laundromat. I don't know how she actually worked there. And eventually she works there for a few months and she hurts herself and she can't work for a few months and she's having trouble finding jobs and she sneaks back to working in kitchens.
Oh no.
None of these agencies will hire her though, because they're essentially looking at her name and they're like, oh no, you have a history. We don't want to deal with that. And in this entire time, the media is not leaving her alone. At this point, they've already named her Typhoid Mary. And there's pictures and ads of her like cooking and like there's toxic fog coming out of her mouth over the food. And they're talking about typhoid and how this happens and all these things. So she can't find a job as a cook. So she just changes her last name. She starts going by Mary Brown and she stops working through agencies and starts working through hotels and restaurants and spas, which again is going to hit affluent areas. Eventually, there's more typhoid outbreaks. People are getting sick again. And she starts working at a maternity, or they call it a women's hospital, which I'm fairly sure is just a maternity hospital. And while she's working there, about 25 people get sick, including doctors, nurses, and all these other people that are staff. And she gets ready to cut town because she already knows. She's seen this before. She, I think, knows what's going on. But the doctor who's working there calls in the same investigator from before. And he's like, hey, can you help us figure out what's going on here? And he comes in. He immediately recognizes her description. He immediately recognizes her handwriting on everything she fills out. And they immediately track her down. She escapes police again and goes into hiding. And they eventually find her when she goes to deliver food to a friend, which, I mean, blessing in disguise. She was taking food to one of her friends who she was probably going to give salmonella to.
Yeah.
And they capture her again and they take her back to the island. And she lives on that island for the remainder of her life. She lived there, I think, over 20 years. In that time that she was living there, she's essentially by herself. She doesn't have anyone living with her. She has a little dog. And she has eventually all these people coming and taking samples. They open a laboratory and that, because it's kind of like a hospital, they give her her own cottage to live at. They open a laboratory and they offer her a job where she works in the laboratory, like cleaning laboratory glassware, not cooking. And she kind of does that one. And then she also kind of finds religion and kind of finds a place there. But essentially, she's kept alone for the majority of her life. And she's there 23 years.
Aww.
Eventually, it's really sad. Eventually, they do find her one day and she's had a stroke and she loses half of her body. She's paralyzed, I think, on her left hand side. And they essentially basically keep her in a hospital until she passes away. And she dies when she's 69. She dies at the hospital. At one point, they did give her rights to go to the mainland just for a day. And they said they gave her phone calls. She said that they didn't really do that very much for her. And when she dies, she has a really small funeral. They do an autopsy. And in their autopsy, they do find that her gallbladder had salmonella. So they were originally saying it was in her gallbladder. They're originally offering to do a surgery. The surgery was really dangerous at the time. So they didn't really know exactly how well that surgery was there. And she resisted. She, again, was pretty scrappy. So she didn't want to have that surgery. But they said in this autopsy, they found it in her gallbladder, which means they were right. However, the lead investigator and several people come back and say that is all urban myth. They never did an autopsy, so they can't prove it. But people were saying that that autopsy got done because there was a media back and forth.
Oh.
So, at first they were coming out as her being really feisty and causing problems and that she was making all these people sick. And then there's kind of a secondary media that came back and said that they weren't telling her what was going on. She had no idea what was going on. They were mistreating her. And then, the hospital or the medical staff was saying that's not the case. She's just being really difficult to work with. And there was like this back and forth. And eventually they kind of start calling her Typhoid Mary. And she was super offended by it because she was like, well, what if they called you, Dr. William Soper, Typhoid William, and those types of things. And so she was very, very upset by the whole thing. Eventually, when she died, there is a lot of media that says that they came back and kind of apologize and say, the treatment of her was non-ethical. It was kind of a poor way to treat people. Mm-hmm. But in that process, they did discover a lot about what was happening. And she is the first documented case of a healthy carrier in the United States. And that later kind of carried on to be what we talk about now when it comes to healthy carriers. So that's kind of the end of her story of her life. But it kind of carries on. Typhoid Mary is now just used as a colloquial term when you talk about someone who gets people sick or brings everyone down in an area. So it can be like, you know, I always call my niece Typhoid Mary because every time she gets a cold, my entire family gets a cold.
Yeah.
And I'll, like, before I go home to visit, I'll ask my parents, like, how's Typhoid Mary feeling? Like, I don't want to get sick when I come home to visit you guys.
Yeah.
Typhoid Mary is a character in Marvel comic books, and she was a character in a Marvel movie. And in the comic books, the character has multiple personalities, and in some of her personalities, she's like raging and is uncontrollable, which is kind of what they were talking about, how hard she was to control. And in the movie, her power in that movie is she can touch people and give them, and it's like poisonous touch or poisonous breath, and she can kill people that way. So it's not necessarily something that's always depicted really well. And so she has kind of this awful thing that's leading behind her. And after she was sick, there was other cases of people that were called typhoid something. So in Chicago, there was an outbreak, and the woman that was in there was called typhoid. I think her name was Jane. And they gave lots of people these type of names. So it kind of carried on for a lot afterwards. Oh, there's a band about Typhoid Mary that they reference her.
Oh, my gosh.
She was in a TV show called The Kink, where she was played by someone. They talk about her story. And even her – have you ever seen the show Warehouse 13?
No, I haven't.
It is a TV show where these historical artifacts are contained like special powers because of their importance. Typhoid Mary's butcher knife is there. And if two people touch the knife at the same time, you can transfer disease from one person to another. So she's actually in quite a few different like movies and television shows and references.
Do we know when the last outbreak of typhoid was?
So it is actually still pretty common. It happens less in the U.S. So not long after that initial outbreak, I think in it was like 1911, they developed the first vaccine for it. And they start having antibiotic treatments for it. But right now, about I think it's close to 10 million cases of typhoid fever still happen around the world. But wow. They are mostly in countries that do not have access to clean water.
Okay.
And over hundreds of thousands of people still die from it.
Oh, my goodness. So we would say that there is a cure now. And is there any things that people should be doing to avoid it or to make sure that they don't come in contact with it?
So there is a cure, or at least there's a treatment, and there is also a vaccine. So if you leave the U.S. and you are going to places that have a risk, they recommend that you get the vaccine. The vaccine loses its potency over a period of time, like a lot of vaccines do. Mm-hmm. But I think WHO just released a few years ago a vaccine that they recommend to children under a certain age and people over a certain age to get this vaccine, and it lasts a little bit longer to help protect you. One of the concerns there is access to it. And, you know, if there's a vaccine but you can't get it to it, or if there's a treatment but you can't get to a hospital or afford to get the treatment, is it really that useful? But over it's like 100,000 people a year still die from it around the world. And now there's actually antibiotic resistant versions of it. And they're finding that it's traveling from place to place. And so that they're also struggling with that.
Do you know what like the initial symptoms are? If somebody thought that they had it, how would you know right away?
So it's similar to what you would think of as having a stomach flu. You're going to have, probably constipation, diarrhea. You might be nauseous, a fever. Some people get a rash, but it is really, really severe. And Salmonella typhi or typhoid fever is one type of salmonella. You can still get salmonellosis from a lot of different foods. Most of the recalls you see within the U.S. are not Salmonella typhi. They're a different type of salmonella, but they can be just as dangerous.
Sure.
You see recalls on it all the time. It's one of the big things. But we also talk about what we do now to prevent it. So we talk about safe kitchen, like washing your hands. We talk about raw meat, chicken, and those types of things. Oh, and that's another thing that was really interesting is one of her arguments was if it was caused by bacteria and I'm cooking my food, you know, why are people still getting sick? That doesn't make sense. It has to be coming from something else or whatever. But one of Mary's famous dishes she served to people was ice cream with fresh cut peaches. So no cooking involved there. So just, you know, she's making you a nice dessert with fresh cut peaches and a little bit of salmonella in it.
Man, it sounds like her life was super sad, especially with the mistreatment. Was there any record of her ever having a boyfriend or a husband?
So she had a boyfriend at the time when they originally had those five cops that captured her. That's kind of how they found out. But it doesn't really look like she ever got married or she ever had a husband once she moved to the island. She was pretty secluded at that time. She did have a little dog, and she had the dog with her while she was on the island, I think most of the time there. But other than that, she was pretty much secluded.
Wow. What a story.
It is. And well, I always talk about, it came into play when they talked about COVID-19 and people were talking about like, well, I'm not sick. I can't give it to anybody. And they had to say, again, you don't have to be sick to be shedding the virus. Uh-huh. There are people who do not get symptoms or don't get very sick who can give it to someone who does get very sick and gets, could die from it even. And that's what the kind of the situation that they had here. And it's still one of the things we talk about when it comes to like basic healthcare is like washing your hands after you use the bathroom. And you see signs in like every single restaurant you go to, like employees must wash their hands. And one of the big concerns is salmonella is transfer from one place to another. And we still have to test it. I mean, that's one of the things Microbac does a lot of testing for is we test food products for salmonella. We test environmental products for salmonella because that's really the best way for us to control it is to know where it's at and prevent it from the market. But you still see dozens of recalls. And I think about 1 million people a year in the US still get salmonella, not salmonella typhi, but they do get a type of salmonella.
Is there a certain type of food that typically carries salmonella more than others?
You hear a lot of it in raw meats. That's where people really associate it because it's a gut, you know, we said it's fecal oral, so it's in your gut. So if you're talking about raw meats that would be from a gut or be exposed to gut, they're going to get that on there. And they see it in chicken a lot. So I think it's about one out of every five or six pieces of chicken, raw chicken, test positive for salmonella. And that's a, there's a whole other story that we could talk about when that really went down in the US. So that's, you know, when they talk about in restaurants, like, oh, cook your chicken, it has to be cooked to this temperature. And, you know, if you handle raw chicken, you have to wash your hands immediately because it's really easy to spread from one place to another. But you also find salmonella in anything that has a little bit of moisture, it can survive with some salmonella. So they find it in like protein mixes and stuff like that, because once it gets there, it just needs a little bit of extra water and a little bit of, you know, nutrients, and you can have salmonella there and it can really be a big issue.
Wow. So as someone who loves to cook, is there any certain ways that I should be prepping or do's and don'ts when I'm working with chicken?
Okay. So I'm a crazy person. If I ever come to your house and you're cooking for me, I have to like leave the room because I will just judge everything you do in your kitchen. I can't think about it. You should be using like different utensils. You should be using different cutting boards. You should handle your raw meat separately from your rest of your food. And then you should never handle raw food at the same time you're handling cooked food. I don't know why I notice that all the time, but I see people all the time. They already have one dish that's done. They'll go and work with raw food or chicken or raw meat, and then they'll go back and work with the dish that's already done. And I'm like, well, you just recontaminated. Even if you cooked it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So it's a huge deal. But we see salmonella recalls in all types of food. I think it's been in ice cream. It was just recently in the cantaloupe recall. Where they found it in all these cantaloupes because it was getting contaminated, again, through knife cutting into raw fruits that people were eating without cooking. So it's kind of in anything. It's just how we are handling it, whether it is the processor, the manufacturer, or once you get it home that you're doing the right things too.
Sure. I've also noticed that they sell wood cutting boards and plastic cutting boards. Is there one that's better or worse for preventing this?
It depends on who you talk to. So I use a wood cutting board because a lot of wood that is actual wood, not pressed wood, has some antimicrobial effects, and it is easy to kind of clean off and keep going. I have a cutting board in my house that has like a hinge on it, so it flips over. I use one side for meat and one side for like fruits and vegetables, so that I have less of a contamination risk there. But I use a wooden one, but you can use plastic ones too, and there's even some that you buy that have special coatings on them that are supposed to be antimicrobial. But the issue is how do you clean them while you're cutting on them? If you damage them, does it still work? And that's one of the big things they talk about plastic ones is, you know, if you have any plastic ones, you probably notice after a while they start to look really bad and they're really hard to clean. Well, that's just a place for bacteria to hide. And so even if you are able to clean it, are you able to get all that out of there?
Right.
I'm a crazy person, like I said, and I have a separate cutting board for meat and I have a separate set of knives that I use for meat that I don't use for anything else.
Well, after this conversation, I might be doing the same.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it's a pretty sad story just because they didn't know what to do with her because this is the first case. And there's a disparity between, you know, people who are doctors and know a lot and these people who are, you know, cooks and maids who don't know anything and they're just trying to make a living. And they're probably not explaining things to her and trying to get her to the right place. And so she's just like, these people are trying to like take over my life. And she just seems particularly feisty and was not putting up with it. And eventually she kind of lived a pretty lonesome life in some situations.
Yeah, super sad.
Well, I'm sorry to give you a sad story, but it's an interesting one.
Yeah, I learned so much. Thank you so much for sharing.
Sure.
Okay, Trevor, let's wrap up with our What Are You Eating segment, where we discuss what we're consuming this week, whether it's pop culture, food, or anything else that we can't stop consuming.
Yeah, let's move into it. We want to do this conversation towards the end. A lot of our segments can be a little dark and sometimes depressing, so we want to have a chance to talk about something that's a little bit more upbeat, a little bit more current, and a little bit more about our day-to-day lives outside of these stories.
Yeah, I know both of us are very interested in pop culture, so we naturally are drawn towards stories that impact our day-to-day here at Microback, so it'll be fun to discuss what's happening in pop culture.
Yeah, sounds great. Let's get into it.
Yes, I was looking forward to this because we are heading to Cabo next week, so I've been jokingly having a Cabo diet, eating a lot of salads and trying to be healthier, and that actually just prompted a question. I read something last week about I cook a lot with garlic and sometimes with onions. And I read this and I kind of freaked out because I will typically cut an onion in half, eat half of it, and then use the other half later. And I read that it's really bad to put it in like a plastic bag and then put it in your fridge and keep it because of the moisture and water, it can grow bacteria quicker. Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Tell me more.
So actually, a few years ago, there was a huge, and it was really hard to find onions because they had a huge contamination that happened in onions. And they had to like throw away tons of them because they're stored in like a giant warehouse. So they couldn't tell which were contaminated and not. So they all had to be tossed. But onions have that little papery outside to it, and that protects it from bacteria as it grows. And after you cut it, you introduce bacteria in there. And even though an onion's got a lot of water in it, they're pretty juicy, I guess. I don't want to think about eating an onion and calling it juicy, but they have a lot of moisture in there. Once that bacteria gets inside, it has all the same nutrients that we like to eat, bacteria-like. They have the right type of moisture. And you put it in the fridge in a bag that has the right conditions. And if you introduce something like you're using the same knife to cut your meat that you're using to cut your onions before you throw them all in a big pan, you probably cook it all out when you're in the pan. But when you put it back in the fridge, it's just left in the perfect conditions to grow. The nice thing is if you put it in the fridge, its bacteria grows pretty slowly. Most bacteria grows pretty slowly under refrigerated conditions. But it still grows. And it doesn't take a lot of salmonella or E. coli to make someone sick. So you can still eat it. Just be careful about eating it raw. And you probably aren't cooking your onions before you're putting them in a salad.
Yeah. What about garlic? Is that the same? I don't always refrigerate garlic, but sometimes I'll peel a bunch and then use it later. Is that one of them? And is there other foods in that category that we should try to be eating quicker?
I don't know about garlic because garlic has got some antimicrobial properties to it. So it's kind of maybe be able to a little bit resistant. But there are recalls on garlic pretty commonly for salmonella.
Yeah.
And they have issues too. So I've seen cloves of garlic turn moldy in my fridge. Like I peeled the whole thing, used half of them, kept some of them, and they turned moldy. So it's growing some sort of bacteria in there. I would say it depends how you handle them, how you store them is really important. They have like those little things that are like tight plastic covers instead of putting them in a bag.
Yeah.
You might be able to use something like that that keeps a little bit less moisture in there or a little bit less airflow, and maybe that prevents it. But I always use the rule, 3-day rule, from the time that you open it or use it, eat it or use it within 3 days or toss it.
Okay. Speaking of garlic having antimicrobial, I don't even know what you would call it, but I read the other day I had a sore throat and someone said to chew raw garlic. Is that a thing?
It seems like you can do anything with garlic. I don't know if there's any research to show it, but like I've heard people of using garlic for all kinds of like ways to help prevent this or help prevent that. I don't know anything about that really works.
Home remedies.
Yeah, there's just these home remedies. And garlic is fairly healthy for you, so it might just be good for you in general and kind of gives you that little bit of a health bump that keeps you going, but not necessarily like – I don't think if you put garlic next to salmonella, it's going to necessarily kill the salmonella right off the bat. But I'm sure if I looked on the internet, I'd find a couple studies.
Got it. Okay, well, tell me what you're eating this week.
Okay, so two things. I am not a breakfast person. I do not like, it just don't like breakfast. It makes me kind of nauseous in the morning, but I'm trying to work out and I'm trying to lose some weight. And one of the ways to do that is to make sure you're eating more frequently. And I discovered these birthday cake flavored protein shakes.
Ooh.
And they are so good, but to the point now where I'm like, I think I'm just eating these like they're milkshakes. Do you ever go to Cold Stone?
Yes, I love the birthday cake remix. Yes,
the birthday cake remix is so good. It is my favorite thing to get. It is super like thick and it has birthday cake in it. It's probably like 2,000 calories. and so I'm like, I can't eat that. So this has been kind of a nice little replacement for me.
Nice.
But it is, I think I'm forming like a little bit of a milkshake habit off of protein shakes, which is not helpful because I'm just, the protein's not doing anything for me at that point.
I was going to say, I love breakfast. It's my favorite meal. When I was little, I liked breakfast for dinner. So my mom said that I called it Brinner.
Brinner.
And yeah, so I'll eat breakfast for any meal. But I have heard that some people just don't do well with eating super early in the mornings.
And, you know, my family loved Brinner too. And there's a couple breakfast items. Like I love biscuits and gravy. I grew up in the Midwest and my mom's from the South. So I like love biscuits and gravy for any time of meal. But like, I don't like bacon or eggs or any of those things. Yeah. So I'm just like, I'm not into it. So, but normally when intermittent fasting kind of came into a big deal, I was like, I've already been doing that for years because I don't
eat. Yeah, I was just going to say.
I've been skipping it the whole time.
Like, yeah.
People are say like, oh, I don't eat till one and people are impressed. I'm like, I never eat till one. Like I'm fine with that one. It's cool. I'm not impressed.
Yeah. I've definitely went back and forth when intermittent fasting came in about trying to do that. And then you, like you just mentioned, you're supposed to eat more often. I was like, well, which one's true? Which one's not?
I don't know if I know either. I'm just trying to do whatever my coach at this gym tells me to. Very bitterly, I might add. I'm never nice about it when he tells me to do things. So we'll see how that goes. Oh, and then the other thing I'm consuming is I went to a drag show and they had a drag performer who did some songs to Jessie Ware, who's been around since 2012. I'm way behind the times, but I've basically been listening to three of her songs on repeat at all times.
Oh my gosh.
When I'm not on a work call, that's the only thing that's playing. and it is driving me kind of crazy because I know I need to do something else, but then I'll listen to another song. I'm like, let me go back to this one and listen to that one again. So if you've never heard of Jessie Ware, you should get on board with her because she's great.
Okay. I will look it up.
Anything else going on?
I think that's it. Just prepping for our trip and our webinar later this week. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, well, I probably should get ready for the webinar too. It's only in a couple of days. All right, Brittany, I will let you go and we'll touch base on our next episode where we'll talk about our next topic.
Looking forward to it.
This has been Okay, But Why? A Microbac Laboratories podcast. Microbac Laboratory operates the largest network of privately held testing facilities in the United States, providing broad analytical offerings and testing insights across the environmental, food, and life science markets.
A company with more than 50 years experience honing its craft, Microbac is on a mission to improve the world around us one test at a time.
To learn more about Microbac testing services and this podcast, please visit microbac.com.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Your support means the world to us. If you want to stay updated on all of our latest episodes, make sure to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed today's show, leave us a review. Thank you.